Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
This is Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Hello.
Hello, it's nice to be back in the loft.
It is. We've been out on the road. We were in Bristol and then you heard the Liverpool episode as
and
well.
And then I was in and been in America. And, you know, when I rang the bell, I felt like I'm coming home.
Oh. You know? And I arranged a little treat for you because as you walked in, a friend of mine was here and I got them to play ABBA's Waterloo on the piano because last night...
I had my Waterloo. I've disproved the idea that there is no bad karaoke.
So this,
that's what you told me. You were lying. I didn't choose effing Waterloo either.
Well, I mean, I do think you were stitched up there. I think like a real key in karaoke is to have the choice of your own song.
Yeah, you need
to
I feel comfortable. I should have done Take On Me anyway.
So,
but I should thank Vicky Foxcroft, Ellie Reeves, and Damien Egan, who's the mayoral candidate in Lewisham, who all sort of were good sports and did it along with me.
And this was the fundraiser you were at, yeah?
Yeah, and we're sort of, you know, we're kind of jamming all the tapes. We're sort of, you know, going out there trying to destroy all the evidence.
Because I had a tip-off last night from Kerry McCarthy MP. She messaged me to say, I'm hearing reports that Ed is on stage singing Waterloo at a fundraiser. Mm. And then I took to Twitter, I did a search for your name, karaoke, yeah. Waterloo, and nothing.
Well, we'd taken advice from the Chinese state and we were sort of jamming all means of electronic communication, actually.
The sad thing about this is, that does this now mean that you won't consider the idea of a Reasons to be Cheerful team karaoke outing?
No, I'm open to it. Maybe next time we'll do it together.
I'm up for
you
it.
You can be Bjorn to my Benny.
I want to be Benny.
Okay, you can be Benny to my Bjorn then. I don't know my Benny from my Bjorn.
Now, before we get on to what we're talking about this week, we have some news and we also need you to do something.
Yes, we've been nominated for another award, two awards, in fact, by the British Podcast Awards, Best New Podcast and Best Current Affairs Podcast. Whoop, whoop.
Yeah.
We're very pleased.
Extremely pleased.
But also
we need your help, because there's a public vote. There's a Listener's Choice Award. Now, Ed and I had a discussion about whether we get into this or not. I'm saying, oh, what's the point? My dad wrote a porno. They've got a gajillion listeners. They're just going to get all their listeners to vote, and we don't stand a chance. But
I have faith in our listeners.
You do?
I have faith, because they are committed, hardcore, you know, people who've brought us to this point.
Basically, what you're saying is you love a public vote. Yes, despite past experiences.
It's gone so well for me.
So you're now in electioneering mode. You're now canvassing for votes.
I am.
So we would like you to go to the British Podcast Awards website, which is britishpodcastawards.com, and there's a nominations section, and within that is a listener choice, and you can vote for Reasons to
Be
Cheerful.
And you can just do it on the website, so it's kind of easy to do. It'll take 1 minute of your time. And of course, the reason we want to do it is we want more people to know about Reasons to Be Cheerful, so they too can be cheerful. So it is entirely altruistic.
It's not because you want yet another award to go on your shelf at home. You've got one, you've got a taste for
it. I'm not refighting the 2015 general election. It's nothing to do with that. It's because we want more people to have the opportunity to be cheered up and hear about good things and make the world a better place.
So do you want to go doorstepping?
Maybe. We might go door to door across the rallies across the country. Get Stormzy.
We need to get a battle bus.
We do. Maybe that's true. John Prescott.
Yeah. Maybe even a new Ed Stone.
Perhaps not.
So it's britishpodcastawards.com and then go to the nomination
section.
Take
a minute of your time.
And we would be extremely grateful. We should talk about what we're talking about this week, and this is something close to your heart.
Yeah, we're talking about climate change, long overdue. I was the climate change secretary from 2008 to 2010. It's something I care a lot about. I think it's something lots of people care about. I think we want to do it in a way that is realistic about some of the challenges, but offers people some solutions. We've got an absolutely stellar cast of people, including Kim Holman, who's the head of the Norwegian Polar Institute. Believe it or not, I met him on my summer holiday in the Arctic 2.5 years ago. I had an extraordinary trip to the northernmost town in the world, Ny-Alesund in Norway, where you get to see, you know, the glaciers, the retreat of the glaciers, what is happening. And he showed me round and showed just an extraordinary, extraordinary experience. And he's a really great and wise person. So I'm delighted to have him. We've got Christiana Figueres, who is the architect of the historic 2015 Paris Agreement, Joss Garman, and Leo Barassi, who both know lots about this subject. So it's a great group of people we've got.
Was that not a depressing summer holiday? Because yes, you're in this beautiful part of the world, but on the other hand, you're just being shown the terrible effects of climate change.
Well, you're not just seeing that, but you're communing with nature, seeing polar bears, all of that stuff. I mean, it was, and you know, honestly, it was sort of fantastic. Dolphins, whales, all of the, you know, the works.
All the big ones.
What's your reason to be cheerful?
My reason to be cheerful is yesterday I...
All your troubles seem so far away.
I did some exercise of sorts. So I was meeting a friend of mine for a cup of tea, and he came along on one of these bikes that you can just rent for half an hour or so on.
Oh, yes.
Not the so-called Boris bikes, yes, or Kensicles, but there's some new company that's doing them, and you can just kind of leave them anywhere. Yeah. So I thought, I'll have a go on that. So I picked up one of these bikes, and I thought, I'm going to cycle home. So I started cycling home, and then just the London traffic was terrifying to me.
I can imagine, yeah.
So I just started pushing along the pavement for a bit. But then I plotted in my mind a route home which would avoid buses and traffic. And I managed to get home. I mean, the feel that I was pushing my own sort of physical limitations to the point of heart attack. But I managed to get all the way home from the city area of London on a bicycle. That's impressive, right? Isn't
it? It's impressive for you. That is massively impressive.
I don't drive. I'm not great on the highway code.
In absolute terms, it's impressive. Yeah. And in relative terms, it's massively impressive.
I went over a zebra crossing when I shouldn't have done and nearly hit a guy's dog, and he shouted after me. I didn't hit the dog. Yeah. But apart from that, it was all without incident, really. So that's my reason to be cheerful.
That is very reason to be cheerful. I give you my congratulations.
Thank you. What's yours?
Well, mine is slightly more sort of sedentary than that. You know, you and I are always looking for good box sets. I cannot recommend highly enough a thing called 10% or Call My Agent. It's a French series about this acting agency and the agents. And honestly, it was recommended to me by a journalist called Sam Coates of The Times. Now, he and I had our run-ins when I was leader, but I tell you,
fisticuffs.
I tell you, if there was a hatchet, it's definitely been buried. He's a brilliant recommender of box sets.
And it's funny.
It's really funny. And, you know, I'm always looking for something. I don't really want politics, right? Because I don't really... I like Designated Survivor, which is this thing with Kiefer Sutherland. But I don't really want something like The Thick of It, because it's like reminds me of
too
what
painful
my life has been like. I don't really... I don't... You know, I like The Bridge and The killing and all that, which I like a bit of sort of escapist murder, but sometimes...
escapist murder!
But the thing is that sometimes that's kind of quite depressing and scary.
Yeah.
There's something about this which is, it's quite funny, it's got some profound bits, but it's sort of... It's not in a world that I'm sort of in, you know, and it's so I really can't recommend it highly enough.
You're listening to Reasons to Be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Well, I'm really delighted and honoured that we're now joined by Christiana Figueres, who was Executive Secretary of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change and was really the architect of the historic Paris Agreement of 2015, and now runs an organisation called Mission 2020, designed to raise the world's ambition on climate change. Christiana, thanks so much for joining us.
No, thank you very much. I'm delighted to be with you.
For people who don't know the detail, can you summarise what was agreed in the Paris Agreement? What were the main achievements of it?
The top line purpose and objective of the Paris Agreement is an agreement among all 195 countries, and parentheses, now after the Paris Agreement, as we know, the United States has communicated that they would like to exit. But they are currently the only one single individual country that is outside of this global effort. Other than the United States, all other countries in the world currently have one shared objective with respect to their greenhouse gas emissions, and that is that by 2050, the world will be at a global economy where we are not emitting more greenhouse gas emissions than what the planet can absorb naturally. So we are on a trajectory of descent, of peaking, let's say, of peaking greenhouse gas emissions by 2020, and a very clear descent after that. What that means is major step up in efficiency, the way that we are using energy, and certainly how we are producing energy, moving quickly from fossil fuel generation to more cleaner and cleaner until we get to renewable energy generation around the world.
And of course, the other big aspect of Paris is to keep global temperatures from rising by more than 2 degrees centigrade, or if possible, 1.5 degrees centigrade, the sort of dangerous tipping point, as some people call it. Christiana, tell us, given the incredible achievement of Paris, how far away are we from actually achieving that overall goal, and what needs to happen now? Because in a way, that's the purpose of Mission 2020, as I understand it.
Yes, so we are actually on track in many sectors. We're definitely on track in energy because we have already invested more than $300 billion into renewable energy last year, and that investment continues globally because of the very dramatic drop in the cost of renewable energy, making a full suite of renewable energies cost competitive in many jurisdictions to fossil fuels. So renewable energy is definitely on track. Mobility has very much picked up speed in the past 6 to 12 months, with most of the vehicle manufacturing companies of the world announcing that they are moving substantial part, or if not all, of their models to electric version and letting go of the internal combustion engine model. Anywhere between starting in 2020 all the way up to 2030. So that will be the decade of full dramatic transformation in mobility around the world for light transport. So in everything that has to do with energy, whether it's transport or energy generation, we're actually doing quite well. You have to understand that this transformation cannot happen at the turn of a dime. It's not something that happens from one night to the next morning. But the trajectory that we have set out is actually the good trajectory. The sectors in which we are not on track yet are definitely the land use and agriculture sectors, where the transformation is much more difficult because it is a very distributed and disseminated sector with millions of farmers participating, and hence behavioral change and practice changes are much more difficult to embark on. and heavy industry, which has a hard time moving its energy practices. So a mixed picture. However, with very good news coming in every day, actually.
And for people listening to this podcast, Christiana, who feel incredibly admiring of your efforts and a little bit more optimistic having heard you, but feel a bit powerless against the sort of massive forces that are out there, what would you advise them to be doing as individuals? I mean, what, and I don't necessarily mean their own behavior, but if they want to get involved, if they care about this, as so many people do, what can they do, whether it's pressuring governments or their own individual behavior?
I think from the point of view of an individual, there are four very concrete things that each of us can and should be doing. And of course, all of this is in the understanding that this is not only a responsibility of governments, not only a responsibility of corporates, but actually it is a responsibility of every single individual alive right now. So there are four things that all of us can do. Number one, what are we eating? If those of us, well, I won't count myself in there because I don't, but those who are still eating meat every single day are truly not living up to any sense of stewardship and responsibility. So what we're eating, and where what the source of that food is, the geographic source of that food, is very, very critical. So we can certainly be much more aware of our eating behaviors first. Secondly, how do we transport ourselves? If in some countries, fortunately not so much in the UK where you and I both live, but in some countries there are many people who are still driving gas-guzzling huge vehicles with single occupants, very irresponsible. So how we transport ourselves and moving toward public transport and toward low-emission shared vehicles, absolutely critical. So what we eat, how we transport ourselves. Thirdly, where is our capital? Those of us who are over a certain age and who have perhaps some disposable capital on our hands should really look very consciously into where is that capital invested. If our capital is in any way supporting high carbon assets, those should be shifted. We should be shifting our capital and asking our asset managers to shift capital over to low carbon or no carbon. And finally, those of us who live in democratic countries should be very, very aware of the power of voting and should be very consciously and intentionally voting for political leaders at the local and at the national level who are aware of this responsibility and of the opportunity of addressing climate change and are going to be supporting climate change friendly policies.
That is a brilliant summary. I must say, I feel empowered by that answer. Just on one follow-up, this thing about pension funds, it may not have occurred to lots of people, but just say a bit more about this, because I think lots of people don't really engage with where their pension money is invested or what their bank does. Just say a bit more about the difference people can make in that area.
Well, actually, on the topic of investments, there are two schools of thought. One school of thought is that if I have my pension in a pension fund, that I should actually lobby that pension fund to exit completely from all high carbon assets and do what is called divest. So to exit completely and starve, if you will, the final effect of that would be to starve high carbon assets of liquidity and of capital in order to force them to shift over to a new business model. That is one school of thought. There's another school of thought that says, well, that may not be the best way to do it. We should remain invested in those high carbon assets and influence through the investor and shareholder meetings. We should be influencing those corporations to shift over. I frankly am not convinced that these two are mutually exclusive. I think both should be pursued. And from the point of view of individual who have their money in pensions, I think you should follow whatever feels right for you. What is unacceptable is to remain blissfully ignorant of the fact that your pension money really does have a huge effect, and not to be concerned about where your money is.
Christiana, I hate to even bring the name up, but you've had Donald Trump saying that he wants the United States to withdraw from the Paris Agreement. At your level, are people saying reassuring things to you? Are people saying, oh, don't worry, it's a madman in the White House. We'll get it sorted out. Are there reasons for optimism, do you think?
Well, ironically, I actually think that what has happened in the United States, or rather in the White House, which is not the same as the United States, has actually helped our cause. Isn't that ironic? For a couple of reasons. First, when Trump announced his intent to leave the Paris Agreement, immediately afterward, you had a opposite reaction, as usually happens in physics. Every action has an opposite and equal reaction. So within 24 hours, you had an opposite reaction from cities, from states, and from corporations in the United States that said, well, that may be the political position of the federal government, but that is not binding on us. We understand we have been decarbonizing for a while. We understand that it's good for our economies, and they are continue to move forward. In fact, over 50% of the real economy in the United States continues to decarbonize because they understand that it has been good for their economy. So that is actually quite interesting. And the other thing that is very interesting is that that opposite reaction that we saw in the United States is mirrored internationally. We have not seen a single country that has now said, the United States intends to leave, then we're also going to leave. Quite to the contrary. Quite ironically, we had two countries that had not joined the Paris Agreement that have joined the Paris Agreement after the announced political move of the United States. So we do not see any international repercussion. Quite to the contrary, we see countries like China and India moving in with a lot of determination and a lot of capital into a leadership space of the new technologies and the new business models. Because if the United States is not going to be taking that leadership, then China and India would like to move in quite aggressively. And just China, to use one example, is investing hugely into renewable energy. Why? Because they are going to get 13 million new jobs out of that investment by 2020. And they are positioning themselves to be competitive in a global economy in which this century is definitely going to be an economy that is on a very, very clear decarbonization path. And they want to continue to be competitive with their exports. So therefore, they want to decarbonize.
Last question, Christiana. When you took over your job as the executive secretary of the UNFCCC, your first press conference, you were asked whether we could get a binding agreement, and you said, not in my lifetime. And you've joked about this.
Indeed.
You've joked about this afterwards. You turned out you proved yourself wrong. Just more looking forward, and I know you're sort of the kind of eternal warrior for optimism, but you know, we're in a race against time. How winnable is this race against time, do you really feel?
You know, I think the answer to that question is one that is focused on the next 2 years. While addressing climate change is a long-term effort, obviously over several decades until we can get to this zero net, so the balance of emissions, and that will not occur until two or three decades from now. But the alarming fact is that whether we're able to get to 2050 on time at the rates of carbon emissions that we need to get to is largely going to be determined over the next 2 years, largely determined by the investments that are made into infrastructure. Because if over the next 2 years, we make the investments into infrastructure that are high carbon infrastructure investments, we're going to be locked in to the greenhouse gas emissions that come with that infrastructure for the lifetime of that infrastructure, which is 30, 40, 50 years. If, however, over the next 2 years, we make decisions that lock us into low carbon infrastructure, then we stand a very good chance of decarbonizing over time. So the answer to your question is that very much depends on what we're doing over the next 2 years. And that's why we're raising the voice of alarm for all of us to understand that we truly are facing a crossroads here in which we can still, even if it is very, very late, we can still address climate change in an impactful way, or we might not be able to.
Christiana Figueres, thank you so much for joining us. That's been brilliant.
Thank you very much.
To get a sense of what is happening right on the front line, we're joined, and I'm really delighted to have him with us. We're joined now by Kim Holman, who's the International Director of the Norwegian Polar Institute. And as Jeff might know, I spent part of my summer holiday in the Arctic in 2015, and I had the absolute pleasure of meeting Kim and him showing me round at Ny-Alesund, which is the most northernmost town in the world. Kim, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's just start with some basics. You live in the Arctic year round. You're an eminent scientist. What do you see happening in the Arctic that you can tell our listeners about in terms of climate change?
Well, wherever I look, I see change. I see a warming Arctic. I see sea ice not forming, open ocean in the middle of the winter. The permafrost, the ground is warming up, thawing. The snow leaves us earlier in the spring. The glaciers are melting by 30 to 40 centimeters per year in thickness in the fronts. You name it, it is change. I see change in the plankton in the ocean. We see new fish, Atlantic cod instead of Arctic cod. And we see changes in birds' populations. And, of course, we also see changes in polar bear behavior.
Tell us a bit about that, because obviously the polar bears is where some people sort of focus, and it so gives people a way of understanding what's going on. What kind of changes do we see?
Well, we must remember that the polar bear was heavily hunted, and we stopped hunting them in 1973. So there is a rebound from that time, such that it's what we see on the ground is a mixed story. But the polar bear is dependent on ice to hunt. They capture seals in the ice or on the ice edge. And as the ice recedes, they are losing habitat. They're losing life space. And there are areas in Svalbard where the polar bear essentially is gone, and it is shifting to the areas where there still is ice. And of course, over time, a few decades from now, clearly the ice has receded so far that they probably are moving out.
Moving out of the Norwegian Arctic Svalbard completely.
Yes.
And Kim, you've seen these changes happening over decades, is that right? I mean, we know that the last winter was a particularly warm winter, but this is like a long-run trend, is it?
Well, it's been ongoing for at least the last 30 years. And I've seen it, I've followed it personally for more than 30 years. Painfully, it's an accelerating phenomenon. So the last 15 years are worse in that respect than the previous 15 years.
And all these things you've talked about, from the polar bears and the plankton and the water temperature, this stuff is without precedent in history. In other words, you feel there's very strong evidence that this is man-made.
Yes. I mean, climate has always changed, will always change, but the rate and the collected evidence from the different expressions of climate, temperature, precipitation, rain versus snow, and many other factors that we look at, Together, they are difficult to explain with any other explanation than human-induced climate change.
For those people who might think we're upset about the polar bears and the plankton and all that, explain how this, if they don't visit the Arctic, or even maybe they don't care about the Arctic, how will it affect them and their children and their children and future generations in the future? Because this isn't confined to the Arctic, even if the effects are most apparent there.
Well, the Arctic is the place where the changes come first and the fastest. They are a forewarning for what is to come for the rest of us or the rest of the planet. The changes here influence weather patterns around the world. They influence the survival of various migrating species. The climate in the Arctic influences climate elsewhere. It can even reach as far as the Indian monsoon. And that, certainly for myself, is a very central element, that it has to do with food security for human beings at large.
Kim, obviously the thing that's happened since I saw you in the Arctic was the Paris Agreement of 2015. Does that make you more optimistic? And how do we need to build on that?
If I look at it as a scientist, the Paris Agreement was far from what has to be done in order to safeguard a good future for our children and grandchildren and life in general. But it was good in the sense that everyone was there and that there was an agreement. We see negative trends in some ways in some countries around the world, but we also see some very positive trends with renewable energy in China and India. There are some very positive trends as well. But I usually answer that question with, I'm an optimist because there is no alternative.
Kim Holman, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
So listening to that with us are Leo Barassi, author of Climate Majority, From Apathy to Action, and Joss Garman, former Greenpeace and IPPR climate director. Joss, we heard there from Kim talking about how urgent it is that we take action. Can you start by giving us an idea where we're up to in the UK with the debate? So I can feel like Brexit dominates everything in the news and everything else is brushed under the carpet. What conversations and debates are being had at government level at the moment?
Yeah, well, you know what? It's actually a like relatively good picture, in the sense that if you look at the last few years, the two countries in the world that have decarbonised at the fastest pace are us and, would you believe it, China, in terms of if you look at the pace of the reductions that are happening in carbon. So just a few years ago, we were getting almost half of all our power in this country from coal. Over the last few days, there's been no coal at all. And overall, we're expecting to have no coal on the system at all within a few years. So British emissions are actually at their lowest level at the minute since the 1890s. So we're actually doing relatively well. That said, we've done the easy stuff and all the hard stuff is still to come. And so actually, if you look at the really big challenge now, it's how do we clean up road transport, so it used to be the case that most of the emissions in Britain came from our power stations, and actually that's no longer the case. More than half of all the power that we generate in the UK comes from low carbon sources these days. More than a third of that comes from renewable energy. So we're doing quite well when it comes to the power sector. Obviously we need to do even better than we are. But the real problem now is diesel cars, petrol cars. How do we get them off the road? How do we start using much cleaner forms of transport? And then we need to start thinking about other sectors like land use. And so people don't really think about it when they think about climate change, but the peat bogs in Scotland and the north of England, huge carbon sinks. You know, how do we protect those peat bogs? How do we start planting new forests again? In any land area where we can, to suck carbon out of the air. And the Queen, you know, said that she's doing a bit of that this week. But actually, we could pioneer solutions like that in the UK and then apply them all around the world. And really, when it comes to Britain's role in the whole climate debate, people often say, look, we're only 2% of global emissions. But actually, if you look at Britain's real value in the global debate over climate change, it's pioneering the technological solutions, pioneering the policy solutions. You know, we were the first country in the world to pass the Climate Change Act, thanks to the man sitting over there. Actually, we've sustained that consensus, to be fair to the Tories, in a cross-party way. And the real challenge now is, how do we take it to the next level, and how do we take it all the way to zero?
We've heard from both Christiana and Kim. Paris was a good thing. It had these quite grand ambitions, keep global warming to no more than 2 degrees C or 1.5. We're already at 1, as I understand it, 1 degree warming compared to pre-industrial levels. How much better do we need to do in terms of what each country is contributing to have a chance of meeting 1.5 or even 2 degrees?
Yeah, so I think at the minute we're way off, right? So all the governments in the world, and it was historic and we shouldn't kind of be too down on it, but every country in the world agreed that we need to get to this goal of keeping global temperatures to no more than 1.5 degrees. And that ultimately means that any pollution we create anywhere in the world by the middle of the century needs to be offset by pollution that we suck out of the air, be that through forests or be that through technology that we use. And that is obviously going to be incredibly challenging to get to. And if you look at the current plans, UK aside, look at the rest of the world, we're so far from that. You know, you still have Germany, which is often looked at as a climate leader, burning coal and creating even new open cast coal mines. And that's supposedly a climate leader. So actually, if you look at all the plans in the world at the minute, they add up to 3 or 4 degrees of global warming. And that's incredibly dangerous. That means, you know, the worst floods that Britain could ever imagine. And it means, you know, potentially the collapse of the Amazon rainforest and the most precious biospheres in the world, like, you know, the Arctic and so on. So the scale of the threat is massive. And at the minute, we're not avoiding it. That said, we've got the technology. And a lot of the things that we have to do anyway, because we're already poisoning kids' lungs with air pollution in London. So we've got to get diesel cars off the road anyway. You know, people are already concerned about wanting to travel in a much more clean way anyway, because of things like noise pollution. People are interested in the jobs and these technologies of the future anyway. So a lot of this stuff we're going to do anyway. Where it gets really tricky is the things that we wouldn't necessarily do anyway. And that's why ultimately we do need to have and win this argument over climate change itself.
Leo, this would be a good point to bring you in. So as an individual, when I was listening to Christiana, I thought, oh, there's a lot I can do. And then when I was listening to Kim, I was thinking, oh, it doesn't really matter what I do as an individual. Big change with society needs to happen. What's closest to the truth? And actually, where are people on this? What's the public mood on it? Are people sort of ready to do stuff?
Yeah, so I'm interested in why public opinion matters and where it is at the moment. So if we think about what needs to happen, there's a bunch of things that we've already been doing and we need to carry on doing that are actually quite far from most people's lives. So things like closing down coal power stations, either people don't notice or when they hear about it, they tend to quite like it because people tend to prefer wind turbines and solar panels to coal. So that's sort of easy. But as we're looking ahead over the next few decades, we're getting towards a bunch of things that are very close to people's lives, and people are either going to notice or they're going to notice and have to support. So Joss mentioned getting people away from petrol and diesel cars onto electric vehicles. Now, public opinion is going to be important there, but it's not all that difficult because we've also got other reasons that that's going to be attractive. So tackling air pollution and things. But where it's going to start getting really challenging and really important what people think is when we start getting to the stuff that you kind of only do because of climate change. So when we start talking about reducing emissions from the food we eat, so that mostly means doing things about meat, so eating less meat perhaps.
Can you explain for people why is that? Is stuff around water and around deforestation, right?
Yeah, so it's quite a subtle thing because it comes from a few different places, but there's a surprisingly large proportion of the UK's emissions come from the food we eat, and it depends how you measure it. You can call it 18%, you can call it 30% if you measure it in different ways. The point is, it's a large chunk, and we're going to have to deal with it. Now, some of that comes from if we're getting meat from South America, then that might be meat that's come from lands that was originally rainforest, or actually more often it's meat that was fed on soy that comes from rainforest that's been chopped down. But also some animals that we eat, particularly cows and sheep, they produce a lot of methane. They burp a lot of methane. And that means...
It's not just you, Jeff.
Cow farts are a huge issue.
So that means that when we're eating meat, essentially that methane was there in the production. So it's a surprisingly large chunk, and it's kind of invisible. So it's not obvious to people. I mean, when we drive a car, it's kind of obvious that's producing emissions, because we sort of see the fuel going in and we can see the fumes coming out. But it's more subtle. And when we start talking about that stuff, then we're not at a place where people get it and get why we'd need to change it.
And what do we need to do then? What do we need to do to convince people?
So if we think about why people are where they're at the moment, psychologists say that the problem with climate change is it's quite distant, it's quite it moves quite slowly, it's not an immediate threat, and humans are really good at dealing with immediate threats. So we can dodge something that's thrown at us, but climate change, it affects other people, it affects distant generations, and it moves slowly. At least that's how it's often presented. But actually, I don't think that's right. And I think the presentation of climate change is something that principally affects the Arctic, that affects polar bears. These are hugely important things, but they're not motivating for most people's day-to-day lives. So the fact that in the last year we've had a record hurricane season in North America, much of the US has been on fire, Southern Europe had a record heat wave, Cape Town came within a few weeks of having to switch off its water supply. These are things that are happening now, and the sort of the sense that climate is a distant thing, I think, should no longer be the case. So there's an urgency to it, but I think also the point that actually this is something that we can do something about, that this isn't an insoluble problem, that this is something that actually is within our control to tackle, and that doing it can make our lives better in other ways is really important.
What is the balance? And this is something obviously I thought about as climate change secretary, and I'm not sure I got it right. What is the balance between disaster warning and positivity? Because the thing we've maybe not talked about is, you know, the green jobs and all of that. Now, that has become, you know, that you can't present that simplistically, but talk to us about the balance.
You've got to do both. And there's a perennial and really frustrating debate in the climate world, with one set of people saying you need to talk about disasters and one set of people saying you've got to be optimistic. And I mean, it was really striking. The New York Magazine had an article earlier this year called The Uninhabitable Earth, which essentially projected how bad things could get. And it was by some distance their most read and shared piece ever. And Twitter, and certainly what I saw, was a huge amount of people who don't talk about climate change looking at that and saying this is the thing that we're really scared about and we want to talk about. So without the threat, you don't get people in. I mean, if this is a thing that is just going to be about generating some jobs, then I don't think that many people are going to be passionate about it. But on the other hand, we know about a ton of global threats. I mean, how often do we talk about antibiotic resistance? Or until David Attenborough, we all knew about plastics in the oceans, but we didn't really talk about it. Until you get something that allows you to think that you can deal with it, then it just goes into that box in your mind of sort of, yeah, this is bad, but I actually would rather not think about it because it's too bleak.
Isn't it weird that the right-wing press love a disaster? Just thinking, now you mentioned the antibiotics resistance, but they haven't latched onto climate change.
Although plastics,
in the same way.
The mail is on, yeah. I suppose the mail is onto plastic. I mean, that maybe that speaks to what your point is.
So the left-right thing is a really interesting problem with climate change. So I ran a poll for the book that looked at the political polarisation. And what I found is that climate change is the single most politically polarised issue out of anything that I tested. So people are more likely
in
to...
In Britain?
So both Britain and US, and it's worse in the US. The polarisation's a bit less in the UK. But people are more likely to think that left-wing people are worried about climate change than any other issue, and more worried to think that than they are to think that conservatives are the people who are most worried about things like defence and immigration and national debt. So it's got really polarised, and that then means if you're not on the left, you look at it as an issue that doesn't really belong to you, that worries other people. And that just makes people in general, it's this in-group, out-group thing. People are just a bit less likely to engage with it because it's not their issue.
I think the other thing is there's been a tendency to think about this as if it's an environmental debate. And obviously it is an environmental debate, but it's also about the entire future nature of our economy. So if we're talking about the power that we're generating or the cars that we're producing or the trade that we're having and the nature of the trade agreements we're striking, like all of this is the climate debate. Like that essentially is the climate debate. So to go back to inevitably we have to talk about Brexit. At the minute, we have a bunch of trade rules about how we trade with Europe that require that, for example, American gas guzzlers just aren't allowed in Britain. That's a requirement so long as we trade with Europe. Well, the US Commerce Secretary has already said that if we want a trade deal with Trump, we're going to have to change our car standards. So these, you know, the practical policy implications of the climate debate are about the entire nature of our economy. You know, questions like, who pays for green investment? So if you look over the last decade, the poorest families in Britain have paid in about six times more as a proportion of their income than the wealthiest families.
And that's through energy prices.
Because of the way that the funding formulas worked. Yeah, so it's gone in terms of quite regressive taxes on energy bills. And then there's been an outcry from the Daily Mail saying, you know, green crap on our bills. And David Cameron says, let's cut the green crap. And actually, there's a kernel of truth in the sense that actually how we have structured it has been quite unjust. So we have to get into all those issues about who pays, who benefits, what are the industries we want to create? What do we do about the people who work in the industries we want to shut down? I mean, there are a lot of people in Britain working in producing combustion engine cars. And in a few years, those jobs just aren't going to be here. So what are we going to do to make sure that those people who rely on that income are skilled up so that they can produce electric cars instead? All of these kind of debates we need to be having. And yet, because it's constantly put into the environment box, people just don't really talk about these issues that much.
So this sense of equity is really important. If we look back five, 6 years ago, then a constant argument for why we shouldn't take action in the West on climate change was because China was building two coal power stations a week. And the fact that the Paris Agreement now means that every country is committed to deal with it really allows us to say, at an international level, this is something that everyone is making sacrifices or making changes to deal with. And I think that ties in with Joss's point that this has to happen both internationally and within our own country. And I think we're getting there internationally. That's happening now. But it's as we move to make changes within our own country, being able to show that this is distributed fairly, I think is something that we just haven't yet got right.
I mean, I completely agree with that. This last point that you've both made, which is the sort of climate justice and social justice have been too much seen as separate. And unless you won't bring people with you, unless there is a sense of fairness about what's happening. We have a thing called the Jeffocracy, which is Jeff being the ultimate ruler, which Jeff is quite keen on. If you were joint climate change secretaries in the Jeffocracy, what's the thing that you, and I know this is like, sounds a bit simplistic, but what's the thing you would do most urgently? Or what's the sort of, what's the way you would approach this, either for Britain or for the world or for both?
Well, I would start by saying we have to finish cleaning up the way that we generate our power, because then we're going to electrify how we move around, and we need to make sure that that electricity is coming from clean sources. Now, we're almost there, as I mentioned, like we've almost got coal off the system. Now we need to get gas off the system. We need to be moving the way that we heat our homes as well. That's going to be really important because that's about a third of all of the UK's emissions as well. It's about how we heat our homes and businesses. So we have to do that stuff first. Then we have to electrify our road transport. So we're all moving around in electric buses and electric cars. And then after that, we have to think about the food that we're generating and how we use our land to make sure that we're planting forests and we're protecting our natural carbon sinks like peat bogs, but also to make sure that we're doing all of that, as you say, in a fair way so that Britain's benefiting and we're getting great jobs and we're, you know, enjoying
having better
our lives
for
and having
people.
Prosperous lives, exactly. Yeah.
So I agree with all of that, but I think the thing that I'd add is whilst we're doing that, we need to talk about it more, because
at
the point at which we start making changes that people notice, if this hasn't been part of our conversation, we haven't been talking about how it affects people, we haven't been talking about the benefits of dealing with it, and we suddenly announce there's going to be all these changes, then most people who actually are worried about climate change and think that it's real are still going to look at that and just sort of be confused and not get why we need to do that. So until we have those conversations, we've got a real risk that this stuff isn't going to happen.
You optimistic?
Yeah, if I look around at the UK...
Yeah, the answer is you've got to say yes on this podcast.
Oh,
no, yes. No, go on. No.
Yeah, if I look around the UK, we've been making great progress. And the fact that we're now looking at actually strengthening our climate change laws is really encouraging. And around the world, countries, governments are taking it seriously. It's going to be hard, but compared with where we were 5-6 years ago, we're in a much better place.
Yeah, and I think, you know, if you look at this in the grand sweep of history and, you know, the rise of fascism, fall of fascism, rise of communism, fall of communism, these huge, like, transformational societal changes happened over just a few years. And already we're seeing how economies that built their prosperity on burning trees and burning coal are now building their prosperity on clean technologies. And so long as we carry on doing that and we speed things up a little bit, we're going to be fine.
But it's urgent.
It's urgent.
Cristiano was saying next couple of years. I mean, we've got to get, governments have got to raise their ambitions in the next couple of years.
But the point is, it's doable.
Joss and Leo, thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure.
Cheers.
What did you make of that, Buster?
I was all over the place. At times, I was feeling really positive. I listened to Cristiano and I'm feeling really positive. Yeah. Then I listened to Kim and I'm thinking, the plankton, the polar bears, the water temperature, yeah. This is terrible. And then Joss and Leo come along and actually it seems like the Conservative government have done more than you might expect them to in carrying on.
They've kept the show on the road, yeah. At least. I mean, I personally think they should have done more, but they've kept the show on the road.
That's something, isn't
yeah.
it? And then, you know, when they started talking about Brexit and how, say, an American trade deal might mean that we end up with these big gas guzzling cars over here, then it got really depressing again. So I don't know, I feel like there's reasons for optimism in there, but it definitely needs to be moved more into the mainstream in terms of the conversations we're having.
I mean, I totally agree with that, and in a way I feel quite guilty because, you know, when you hear about the scale of the challenge, and also, you know, I think Kim is really moving. We'll post a video of him talking about some of these issues, just a short video. Kim Holman from the Arctic, you know, it's the most extraordinary place, the Arctic, and you know, this existential threat to a lot of what is valued about it is really real. But I suppose I feel more focus and more urgency in political debate, getting fairness as part of it, not, oh, well, let's care about the environment and then let's deal with fairness somewhere else. But then you'll never take people with you if people think it's unfair and hits the poorest hardest and so on. And then I think this other thing, which is, yes, do warnings about the dangers because you can't ignore them, but also we're about better lives for people. And by tackling this, you can create better lives for people. And that, you know, electric cars, which are not polluting, warmer homes that are properly insulated, you know, a clean power, you know, all of the cities that are built for not just for cars, but for walking around, for bicycle, you know, it must be possible to present a vision of this as we're going to decent jobs for people, you know, decent jobs in green industries, the industries of the future. So present that picture of a better life, and then I think we might do better at taking people with us.
Reasons to be cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Well, as ever, we would love to hear from you. You can email us, reasons@cheerfulpodcast.com. You can tweet us at Cheerful Podcast or find us on Facebook, facebook.com/reasons to be cheerful podcast. This comes from George Wilson, who says, I listened with interest to the gentrification episode, but felt a bit uncomfortable listening to it, to be honest. I think of myself as someone with fairly centrist views, with a slight lean to the left. However, I did feel that the gentrification episode was a little one-dimensional, predominantly because I seem to be part of the problem. My wife and I, both in our early 30s and in professional jobs, were lucky enough to purchase a house in East London 2 years ago. The area probably would have been described then as up and coming. It's further up now, with more people like us having arrived, and the area has the usual amenities, cafes, delis, etc., etc. These are interspersed with corner shops and other things that have been there for a while. I often hear complaints about the incomers changing the area. My issue with that is, where are we supposed to go? I completely understand that we're in a very privileged position and will probably elicit minimal sympathy, good, well-paid jobs, in a position to move house and so on. However, when we were looking at areas to move to, we've been priced out of everywhere else. It's an interesting question, isn't it? I think there's two things. The underlying housing problems, which we seem to come back week after week after week, the lack of housing stock, that's a big one. That's out of your hands. I do sometimes feel as if people move into areas, I'm not saying you're like this, George, but and they treat the existing community as extras that make it feel a little exotic or diverse without actually engaging with that community. So sort of finding that cohesiveness could be part of the solution to that.
Yeah, I mean, or maybe it's about making sure that there's enough social housing in areas, that housing remains affordable. I mean, look, you know, affordability is like a cascade effect. It has an effect on everyone, whatever your income level. You know, people can be priced out at different levels. I think it's so people who've grown up in communities don't feel they can just no longer afford to live there. Mm. But I mean, I think the best solution, as you say, is to solve the housing, like build lots more housing, including lots more social housing.
I do love a good deli, though.
By the way, talking of culinary amenities, as you might say, there is a crepe place that got tweeted in Bristol. I just missed it, obviously. I don't think it's at the station, or maybe it's further down from the station. So we're going to have to go back.
So we blamed Network Rail for forcing the crepe stall out.
Well, I don't quite know. I can't. I haven't got complete clarity, but there is.
Why haven't you devoted your entire week to finding out what happened to that crepe stall? I should have
done. The next one comes from Harriet from London. First, I absolutely love the podcast. It's by far the best podcast at the moment. I want to respond to episode 28 and especially Jeff's point. That's you, Sunshine, that he doesn't mind his data being held by the big data companies. I work in digital marketing, and I'm always amazed at how detailed the targeting options are on Facebook, and I don't think people who use Facebook fully understand how much data they hold about you and how advertisers, political parties, or literally anybody who signs up for a Facebook advertising account can use this data. For a savvy marketer, the possibilities to individually target very niche groups are endless. You can tailor adverts for insurance, for those who've just bought a car, flog birthday present ideas for those whose dad's birthday is coming up, tell the girl whose best friend has just got engaged that as your friends get married, you deserve to treat yourself, etc., etc. And then she goes on, you could potentially tailor 100 different political campaign videos to all of those different groups, as you can create adverts that are only visible to the particular groups that you target. Not only is this a nightmare for accountability in, say, elections, how can you audit campaign posts that you can't see? It also causes divisiveness. You might have a completely different view of the political landscape than your neighbour just because you see different news stories that affirm your existing biases. Reuters reported that 2/3 of American adults get their news on social media, so I cannot overstate this problem enough. So she basically says, people like Jeff don't care that their data is out there because they think in terms of the information they actually give to Facebook, like their name, hometown, date of birth, but actually it goes much beyond that. The ability to do harm is enormous, even if you do live in a politically and socially liberal society. If you're not so lucky, the amount of information a hostile government could collect about you, your friends, your family, your locations, and your past and predicted behaviour might be scarily accurate and useful. Does it have an effect on you?
So I think that bit is especially terrifying. When I think about targeted advertising, I think like everywhere we go in modern life, advertising exists and all this money is spent on it, but most adverts, most people will never react to. So surely that money is better spent if the advertising is targeted to the sort of person who might buy it. But then when you start muddying the waters with political advertising, then it feels kind of icky.
I mean, it's one thing if you're buying a new pair of espadrilles or, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
But I think it's quite another thing if you're being, targeted with big political...
Because sometimes I'll see an advert for a burger chain pop up online or something. I think, well, whoever the advertising agency is has wasted their clients' money, because you should be able to know from my data that I'm a vegetarian.
Yeah, that's true.
So there's some positives to it. But do you not think it's about regulating political advertising very tightly? We're pretty good on that in this country, compared to
not
America,
so good online,
example.
I don't think, actually.
No, so is it a question of we've just been slow to adapt to the modern world? But then it's so labyrinthine. How do you...
I think we're still in the foothills of understanding what we need to do,
This comes from Amy Kuntz, who says, "Greetings. My boyfriend is a big fan of your podcast. I confess that I've not listened to them." Well, thanks, Amy. Thanks for taking the time
to
find out
you guys feel
the email address, though. However, I feel as though I have, as every now and then in conversation, he'll just casually say, "Well, on Ed Miliband's podcast, they were saying..." One of these occasions was when neither of us could sleep. I was quite tired, so the details are a bit fuzzy. But after this conversational segue, one of us made the joke, "What do you call Ed Miliband when he's sleepy?" "Bed Miliband." It all went downhill from there. I'm going to include some of these terrible jokes in the hope of amusing you. What do you call Ed Miliband when he's eating his favourite type of cream?
I don't know. What do you call Ed Miliband when he's eating his favourite type of cream?
Ed Chantilly Band. What do you call Ed Miliband when he's just feeling fun and flirty?
I don't know.
Ed Silly Band. What do you call Ed Miliband after a day at the seaside?
I don't know.
This is particularly bad. Ed Millisand.
Yep.
What do you call Ed Miliband when quoting him directly?
I don't know.
Said Miliband.
Right.
Yeah. There were many of these. Oh, feel free to send more.
Christmas bestseller, I think.
Yeah. We could do Reason to be Cheerful crackers.
Yeah, exactly.
With these in them. So thank you for those, Amy.
Oh, thank you, Amy. Thank you, Amy, and your boyfriend. I hope you eventually got to sleep.
Email us reasons@cheerfulpodcast.com. Follow us on Twitter @cheerfulpodcast or search for our Facebook page, Reasons to be Cheerful Podcast.
Vote, vote, vote. Vote, vote, vote. British Podcast Awards.
Is this going to be?
Vote.
Is this going to be relentless now? Is there an election?
Relentless.
We're in an election period.
It's a permanent campaign.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So BritishPodcastAward.com. Go
vote, vote, vote.
Vote, vote, vote. Vote early, vote often.
Exactly.
And all that. Yeah.
Exactly.
We need a loud hailer. We need to, me and you, go out in your car. I can hang out the window
good
with
idea.
A loud hailer.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. You're on.
It's a good idea. People might think we've gone a bit bonkers wonkers, really.
Bonkers wonkers. There's another one for the collection, everyone. I'll tell you what I was very surprised about in this episode.
Yeah.
That you're a centigrade guy, that you use the word centigrade.
What, as opposed to Celsius?
Yes. So you got Mr. Celsius. He invented his scale. It's a great scale. Water
centigrade
freezes.
Is a made up.
It's a made up word. Yeah, it's Mr. Celsius.
But where does it come from, centigrade?
I don't know the etymology of it, but it always feels to me like British people not wanting to say a foreign sounding word, so they invented.
Who was
centigrade.
Mr. Celsius?
He was Swedish, and he was the guy who came up with that scale where water freezes at zero
and because he's Swedish.
And boils at 100. And I do, as a Swedophile, I feel quite protective of
another
him.
Another reason to be
and
Swedish.
It annoys me if I'm ever on a plane and the pilot. It gives out the temperature in centigrade. Say, no, you Celsius. But not as much as Fahrenheit annoys me. I'm very anti-Fahrenheit.
Really?
Yeah. I feel that what people do is they're happy to use Celsius when it's cold, but then when it's hot, they want the number to be as close to 100 as possible.
So they can say, it's...
Yeah, exactly.
It's a few water scorcher.
Yeah.
Maybe you're going to have a scorcher for your birthday tomorrow.
It certainly looks like it.
Yeah.
I'll have to...
Outside on the South Bank.
Yeah, I mean, I'll be looking for places with good air conditioning, which perhaps
so you really
isn't
don't
in
like
the spirit
heat.
Of our climate episode.
You really don't like heat.
Every now and again, yeah.
It's a shame.
Yeah, I've got my own little system. 20 to 25, I'm quite happy with, usually.
Yeah. Should we do some thanks?
We should.
Use? Thanks to Christiana Figueres. Thanks to Kim Holman. Thanks to Joss Garman. And thank you to Leo Barassi. I thought fantastic guest.
Yeah, brilliant. And Emma Corsham produced our podcast with backup research from Alex Feisbrice and Lindsay Todd. Gail Lofthouse is our announcer, and we're going to Sheffield to do a show this week, and Gail is going to be joining us, which I've never met Gail in the flesh.
I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, so Gail's our announcer. James Deacon made our identity.
Ed Seed did our music.
He did. He composed
and Emily
music.
Power did our design.
This is right. He's been Benny.
He's been Bjorn.
And these have been
Super Trooper.
Please let's have that karaoke night soon.
Hey, marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.